I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Marina Warner and Chloe Aregis, thank you both very much for being here as well. Chairing the event this evening, we also have Joanna Biggs and Alice Spalls, both editors at the London Review of Books, and crucially this evening, co-founders of Silver Press.
Along with Sarah.
And Sarah, sorry. Where's Sarah? Hi, Sarah. Sorry, Sarah. Tonight, as usual, there'll be discussion followed by time for your questions. That's it. Please join me in a very warm welcome to our panel. Thank you.
So we're here. The reason why the book's been published is because it's the centenary of Leonora Carrington. Her birthday's on Thursday, so you should celebrate then. Along with our book is the first collected, complete edition of her stories, and there were split across two editions in Virago. There are things here that have never been, three stories that have never been published before. And we can finally see her work in full, really, by doing this. And so I wanted to ask Marina Warner, who's written off afterward, to read a story.
A Man in Love. Walking down a narrow street one evening, I stole a melon. The fruit seller, who was lurking behind his fruit, caught me by the arm. Miss, I've been waiting for a chance like this for 40 years. For 40 years, I've hidden behind this pile of oranges in the hope that somebody might pinch some fruit. And the reason for that is, I want to talk. I want to tell my story. If you don't listen, I'll hand you over to the police. I am listening, I told him. He took me by the arm and dragged me to the depth of his shop among the fruit and vegetables. We went through a door at the back and reached a room where there was a bed in which lay a woman, motionless and probably dead. It seemed to me that she must have been there a long time, for the bed was overgrown with grass. I water her every day, the greengrocer said thoughtfully. For 40 years, I've been quite unable to tell whether she is alive or dead. She hasn't moved or spoken or eaten during that time. But, and this is the strange thing, she remains warm. If you don't believe me, look. Whereupon he lifted a corner of the bed cover, and I saw a large number of eggs and some newly hatched chicks. You see, he said, that's where I hatch my eggs. I sell fresh eggs, too. We sat down on opposite sides of the bed, and the greengrocer began to tell his tale. I love her so much, believe me. I've always loved her. She was so sweet. She had nimble little white feet. Would you like to see them? No, I replied. Anyway, he continued with a deep sigh, she was so beautiful. I had fair hair, but she had magnificent black hair. We both of us have white hair now. Her father was an extraordinary man. He had a big house in the country. He was a collector of lamb cutlets. The way we met was this. I have this special little gift. I can dehydrate meat by just looking at it. Mr. Pushfoot, that was his name, heard about me. He asked me to come to his house to dehydrate his cutlets so that they shouldn't rot. Agnes was his daughter. We immediately fell in love. We went away together in a boat on the Seine. I was rowing. Agnes said, I love you so much, I live only for you. and I used the same words to reply to her. I believe it's my love that keeps us so warm to this day. No doubt she is dead, but the warmth remains. Next year, he went on with a faraway look in his eyes, next year I shall plant some tomatoes. I'd be surprised if they didn't do very well in there. Night fell. I didn't know where we could pass our wedding night. Agnes had become so pale from exhaustion. At last, just as we left Paris behind, I saw a cafe beside the river. I moored the boat, and we walked up to the dark and sinister terrace. There were two wolves and a fox prowling around us. Nobody else. I knocked. I knocked on the door, but it remained closed on a terrible silence. Agnes is tired. Agnes is very tired, I shouted with all my might. Finally, an old crone hung out of the window and said, I don't know a thing. It's the fox who's the landlord here. Let me sleep. You're getting on my nerves. Agnes began to cry. There was nothing I could do but speak to the fox. Have you any beds? I asked him several times. He didn't reply. He couldn't speak. Then the crone's head, now even older than before, came down slowly from the window at the end of a piece of string. Speak to the wolves. I am not in charge here. Please let me sleep. I understood that the crone was mad, that there was no sense in going on. Agnes was still weeping. I walked around the house several times and in the end managed to open a window through which we entered. We found ourselves in a high-ceilinged kitchen where there was a large stove glowing red with fire. Some vegetables were cooking themselves, jumping around in boiling water. This game delighted them. We ate well and afterwards lay down to sleep on the floor. I held Agnes in my arms. We didn't sleep a wink. There were all sorts of things in that terrible kitchen. A great number of rats sat on the threshold of their holes and sang with shrill, disagreeable little voices. Foul smells spread and dispersed one after the other, and there were strange draughts. I think it was the draughts that finished off my poor Agnes. She was never herself again. From that day on, she spoke less and less. At that, the owner of the fruit shop was so blinded by his tears that I was able to make my escape with my melon.
So wonderful. I think I know some reasons why you chose that story, but tell us a bit about why, what that story does, why it fits in Eunora's work, why it's interesting, why that one.
Well, it catches that blend of comic and a truly dreamlike. I mean, yeah. A truly original too. In a sense, you've never encountered these kinds of sequences of thoughts before. Sometimes she sounds quite gothic,
yeah.
But at other times it's a very authentic, peculiar mixture. And then she has this signature interest that everything is alive. So I think a particularly Leonora kind of sentence, which you wouldn't find in another writer, is the vegetables jumping up and down in the boiling water, enjoying themselves being cooked, having volunteered for this. And there's a kind of undermining of romanticism. You know, she's probably very, very young when she writes this, but she's already pretty canny about men who say they're desperately in love. You know, she's got a kind of real sense of the... You know, she cuts through a lot of flummery.
You know that bit where he insists that his love is keeping this dead body warm, alive in that way?
Yeah, yes.
Chloe, did you have... I mean, did that story speak to you in certain ways? I mean, when you were reading it, I thought about the melon suddenly alive in its way that I hadn't realised the way it could, you know. I wonder if there's anything in that story that means anything to you, really.
Well, again, this feeling of imprisonment and captivity and fighting against, and also the, as you said, the vegetables coming alive and having souls.
Yeah. I think it's the ordinariness, too, isn't it? She has some very great paintings, which are of cabbages, and so she or of a yam. So she likes the creaturely, which I think is why it's called female human animal. But it's also because she likes the quotidian. You know, she likes the things that are around you. She makes these potent concoctions out of ordinary ingredients.
There's surrealism, right? Yeah. They're both,
But it's not so exotic or orientalized as some aspects of surrealism.
And as with so many of these stories, we have a narrator who is sort of such a wonderful avatar for the reader of the story, you know, someone who's held captive, having to listen to this story when they just want to make off with their melon. And is sort of saying, you know, this is happening, I'm not doing this. You know, she has a sort of disdainful attitude to her own creativity sometimes, her fancifulness. Mm.
Tell us a bit about how you came to know her, Marina.
It's a chapter, really, of a feminist history, because what happened was that in the 80s, and there may be people in this room who remember this period, there was a kind of search for, you know, great figures, and certainly within the visual arts. This is the time when, pretty much around the time when Germaine Greer wrote her book, it was called Old Mistresses. So she went around to numerous museums all over the world. She did this immense archival work. And in a way, it's sort of dated because, you know, we have moved on. So it's interesting that there was a sort of attempt to excavate people. So I was sort of part of that. And Whitney Chadwick, who did the original sort of spade work on the forgotten female surrealists, this was very much part of the same movement. Mm. You know, who has not been acknowledged? Whose voices have been muffled? Whose work have we not seen?
Yeah.
And Whitney Chadwick brought out a really exceptional book, which has been reissued and updated, in fact. And she really pioneered rediscovering these muses who had been seen only as beauties and been much photographed and were very quite well known, many of them, from their photographs rather than from their actual works.
People like Lee Miller as well.
Exactly. Lee Miller, you see, was not, you can probably not hardly believe this, but in the 80s she was sort of forgotten. So she had to be, it was Anthony Penrose, her son, who by archiving her work extremely carefully, very well, and actually rediscovering a lot of her work, brought her into the sort of absolute visibility that she now rightfully enjoys. Mm-hmm. So it was a sort of moment of historicizing the roles of women in the past. And I worked on Eleonora, and then because I was kind of working on her, people noticed it, and I was asked to look at the collected short stories in the E.P. Dutton edition of the 80s. And they were... had been translated by Catherine Talbot, who was a very well-known translator. But I worked on the translations a bit as well. And there were two volumes. And so after that, I decided to obviously try and meet her. And I was actually making a film with Gina Newson. Gina Newson and I, this is another chapter of history, which is that in those days, Channel 4 had a live, very, very lively arts program. And all you needed to do was put up a good idea, and you'd be given seed money to go and find out more about the topic. It's extraordinary that that existed. And so that's what happened. We said, Leonora Carrington, very good subject. Yes, he said, here's £200, in those days, enough money to go to New York, find her, and or something, very little money. Mm-hmm. And we went to New York, and we found her, and she was living in this basement flat, a basement apartment, because she had a great fear of heights, and she'd come to New York by bus. She never flew, which is partly why she didn't return to England, because she had broken with her background completely, except for her mother's death. She came back for that. But otherwise, she never flew. So she took the coach with all the kind of illegal workers. She was very proud of that, crossing the borders, you know. And then she holed up in New York. At that time, she was in flight from Cheeky, her husband, whom you knew, I think.
Why was he not behaving?
She was bored with him. But unfortunately, because she was brought up a Catholic, she had a kind of, you know, she decided that she ought to, when he got ill, she went back and nursed him. She went back on the bus and nursed him.
Until he was 97.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but she did have that streak. I mean, she was a very, very, I mean, you know that better than I do. She was a very warm person. She wasn't at all sort of icy and hard.
No. So had a sense of duty.
But she was just exasperated with him. She just found him totally tiresome. And she was still so, you know, fertile and exuberant and imaginative and active that for her to have this sort of person who was always sort of fussing about, you know, the way...
How old was she when you met her?
Well, it was 1986, so she was born in what?
17. Chloe's written this wonderful... Chloe knew him in Mexico.
So I met her in the early 90s. So around 20 years, no,
well, 10 years
10 later. Years after. Yeah. So a very different chapter.
When she'd returned, yes.
When she'd returned.
And do you want, Chloe's written this wonderful A to Z of
memories. Of
yeah, her. Which I think you should read to give us a sense of what she was like.
And so I met Leonora because there was a doctor, wonderful, wonderful doctor in Mexico named Teodoro Cesarman, who was doctor to almost all the writers and artists and so-called intellectuals. And he wouldn't charge anyone, and in return he'd get paintings or books or prints or drawings. And so he was our family doctor until he died, and then he was Leonora's doctor. And so my father had met Leonora in the 70s, but then they hadn't crossed paths again. But then one Sunday in the early 90s, we went, I'd been living abroad, but I was visiting home, and we went to Teodoro's house for lunch. I met Leonora there, and immediately a friendship was struck up, and she said, what are you doing? It was probably a Saturday, and she said, what are you doing tomorrow, tea time? And it became a ritual every Sunday, going to her house for tea after lunch. And, my parents would go most Sundays, and I'd go when I was visiting home. But and so often, it was so memorable, everything she said, and it just felt there was such a continuum between her work and her speech that I'd go home and take notes.
Yes.
I never necessarily thought I was going to publish anything, but I just thought, I knew that I didn't trust my memory. So anyways, and then I assembled them into this A to Z that I'll read now. And it's a new academic tome called Leonora Carrington International.
It's got loads of wonderful pictures in it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And editor Mike, oh yeah, one of the editors is here, Catriona. So an A to Z of Leonora Carrington memories, mostly in quotes, gathered over years of visits to her home. So A, ambidextrous. Leonora could write with both hands at once, forwards and backwards. Yes, I'm ambidextrous, like madmen, she once said. B, bullfighting. Horrific. It's a disgusting, shameful demonstration of human stupidity and cruelty. Horrible. I was once put out at a bullfight. I got up and clapped when the bull jumped over the thing and chased all the attendants around, and I just clapped and clapped, and they put me out. C, cats. The last cats Leonora owned were Ramona and Monsieur, two green-eyed Siamese who followed her around the house. She wanted a dog too, but worried the cats would stop speaking to her. D, devils. This was when I asked her once whether she believed in the cult, and she said, well, it depends. And then she said, I think they're very dangerous devils, and I think they're interesting devils, and I think they're very stupid devils. I think they're probably intelligent ones, and angels and anything that has been invented. Hundreds, thousands of them, all over the place. Well, I use the word invented when I mean seen. I don't know what invented means, really, do you? E, England. Leonora would express nostalgia for England, but at the same time had no desire to return. She missed the trees and the architecture, she said, rather than the people, since most of those she knew had passed away, and the eventful moments of her life had taken place abroad. F, filters. Until her final days, Leonora smoked. Her choice of cigarettes varied, but she always attached them to short plastic filters, which she would clean and reuse. And often she'd, with also F, Fiskars scissors, enormous scissors, she'd cut off the tips of a cigarette, put it down, and then relight it a few puffs, and then put it down and snip the ends. G, gray. More than anything, Leonora wore gray. Again, this is in the years I knew her, maybe more colorful. Also, yeah, okay. More than anything, Leonora wore gray. Baggy gray trousers, long gray sweaters, gray shawls, gray turtlenecks, gray lace-up shoes. Occasionally she'd bring in a bit of purple, but my memory of her is distinctly in monochrome. H, haunting. This will come to again. Leonora would sometimes mention a middle-aged woman in pink who would appear in different rooms of the house. A few friends claimed to see the ghost as well, standing behind her. She was never scared, however. In previous times, her home had been a printing house, which is not a very sinister thing, she said. I, imagination. Nothing is created by the imagination. Imagination is a very mysterious force, which we know very little about. We don't know if it creates anything. I think that things occur. Like, for instance, somebody one time must have invented a cup because it was easier than putting your face into a river and lapping up the water. I love that. J, Edward James. Englishman in Mexico, patron of the Surrealists, Leonora was fond of him, despite saying he lacked respect for his friends and would wash his hands with her shampoo. More than once she complained about that. Kay, Kabbalah, the book Leonora would mention most frequently, important to her throughout her lifetime. L, Lapland. Often when we'd ask Leonora what place she would most like to visit, she would reply, Lapland. She loved reindeer and wished the Laps would stop eating them. M, manipulation. Leonora said manipulation is what makes the great cosmic yogurt. N, Nagas. Some of Leonora's favorite mythical creatures from Indian mythology, which featured in her paintings and sculptures. There's a crocodile-like, the most famous ones in a boat. O, Orange Pico. Leonora would often ask me to bring her a tin of tea from England, especially Orange Pico. She also loved PG tips, bog standard English tea, she called it, and said she much preferred it to fancy teas. Whatever I brought her, she would keep under lock and key, with the key around her neck, so that no one else would use it. Cache la boîte, the PG tips, I should say. P, painting. I rarely paint images from dreams. Images occur just like that. They occur from something that is further away from my consciousness, I think. But any painter would tell you that. Q, quel désir d'extravagance. André Breton's words upon first seeing her paintings in Paris when Leonora was 20. R, Colonia Roma, was the neighborhood where she lived in Mexico City from the 1940s onwards. Over the decades, it underwent an enormous transformation. Across the street lay the debris of a collapsed building, a victim of the 1985 earthquake, which housed a growing community of cats and homeless people. Leonora called it a garden of scorpions. S, spiritism. Leonora could see through the hocus-pocus of people who claimed to have supernatural powers. She once played a trick on a very serious ex-Nazi with a thick German accent, those are her words, who held a seance. She brought along one of her sons, and before the session, they attached a small instrument to the bottom of the table. It made metallic noises whenever it was pulled by a string. Everyone sat down. After a while, Leonora began to grow bored and decided to play a trick on the ex-Nazi. She or her son pulled this string. Noises were heard coming from beneath the table. Leonora remarked, I think there's something there. So the ex-Nazi asked, who are you? And she replied, I think it is a horse, of course. The man stood up and tipped the table over to reveal the hidden instrument. He was livid and never spoke to Leonora again. T, time. I don't need to kill time, it's killing me. She replied, when I asked whether she played chess, she replied that she was uninterested in board games. She'd rather draw. U, University of Contraception. Leonora's idea. She'd often complain there were too many people in the world and wish they would establish such a university. V, Remedios Varo. Feline-faced Spanish painter, one of Leonora's closest female friends with whom she shared a love of cats. W, Americo Weiss, also known as Chiki. Hungarian photographer to whom Leonora was married for over 50 years, largely in silence. X, Xanax, Tafil in Mexico. Leonora would take half a tablet every night for sleep and anxiety. The darkness would set in by late afternoon, she said. Y, Yeti, Leonora's final pet, a small white hyperactive Maltese for whom she had tremendous affection. Z, zoology. Leonora adored animals, mythical and real. And this is a quote from her. I draw completely from my mind. Well, I don't know if it's my mind, but if I'm drawing an animal like a cat, I'd like to draw it from life.
And she wanted to talk us through those photos as well.
Yes. Oh, okay. So, well, I guess we can start with Cheeky. This was towards the end of his life. He lived to be 97. And that's one of the cats. I don't know if it's Ramona or Monsieur. But for the last 5 or 8 years of his life, he spent, he was mostly homebound. And he lived in his room. They'd separate rooms connected by a, well, there was a bridge and an outdoor patio. But he'd watch television, a very snowy screen, terrible reception, but he didn't seem to mind. It was mostly nature programs that he'd watch. Csiki was a Hungarian Jew who said his family had been killed in the Holocaust. Lenore would call him a drama queen and sometimes say it wasn't true, but I think it largely was. When we first met them, he had a dog named Marouche, who was already quite old, and he would walk Marouche. And I never, in all the years I knew him, I never saw Csiki without his beret. He always wore his beret. First he was Robert Capa's darkroom manager. He said he walked from Budapest to Paris with Robert Capa in the 30s. And then he married Leonora. And then he spent 50 years as the photographer at the Rotary Club and ate lunch there every day. But he was very much...
That's in Mexico City.
The Rotary Club in Mexico City. But he was very used to not being the protagonist and being very quiet and silent. And they only spoke French together. He never learned English. And they spoke a very old-fashioned French.
But she still would say cachez la boîte in French.
Yeah, well, she slipped between languages, right, so French, okay. Spanish, English.
Yeah.
So she'd always say cachez la boîte, the PG tips. And then she'd also hide her whiskey in a... She didn't trust the people they were... There was a woman named Yolanda who worked there. And then someone named Salvador with a ponytail who also worked for Alan Glass, a Canadian artist, a good friend of hers. But she... I think it was a combination of not trusting anyone, but also there was something exciting and magical and almost transgressive of retrieving something from a locked box or cabinet, and whether it was her tea or her whiskey.
Are there secret things in the stories? I'm trying to think if there are moments like that.
Well, I think that she was very concerned. I mean, there is this Kafka streak of this borough idea, and everything being orderly in the borough. And she liked living in small places and to be tucked up. And when we went to the Metropolitan Museum, she wanted to look at all the figures who were swaddled.
Right.
So we went on a quest through the museum looking for Jesus swaddled as a baby, for mummies swaddled. And if you look in her work, and this idea of unwrapping and wrapping, and that does connect to secrecy.
And the cabbages also.
It'd be a good way of looking at reading the stories, actually, to look for imagery of concealment and safety in concealment, in being wrapped.
But it's an uneasy relationship, because sometimes being buried means being destroyed or being suffocated, especially by parents, mothers and fathers who are sort of clothing their children too assiduously and destroying their agency. That does come out.
Yes, and the wildness, of course, her love of the feral, but it's the feral animal that's also a burrower. And creating a space that belongs to the... to herself or itself, but the imagery that runs through it is the imagery of devouring, which is also feral. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it's Eucharistic. There's a lot of eating, consuming, and food. The imagery of food is very, very powerful. In rather gorgeous ways, actually. Mm-hmm. Not foodie ways, but.
Although she does always mention the vintage when it comes to wine.
Yeah. Wines. But I just wanted to add one thing, sorry, to your lovely alphabet, and that is that she painted with both hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that, because writing with both hands is not as unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, to see her painting was extraordinary, and one does wonder.
Well, you said it at the same time as
At the same time, She would. She had brushes in both hands. She'd paint with both hands. Which actually, if you think about it, is very. It's rather odd that people don't do it more, because after all, you play a piano with both hands. You play a violin with both hands.
That suggests something more intuitive. That you're doing it with almost without looking at what you're doing. As though it was coming.
Well, you know, she was.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Emperor. So she mixed, it was a form of cooking, yeah. Because she would mix the egg yolks,
yeah.
and the pigment. So yeah. it was done in the kitchen in New York, when she was in New York. I don't know in Mexico whether she had a separate studio.
On the roof.
But the other thing that you mentioned about dream is that she did actually have quite a theory of that, because she was, in this sense, rather Jungian. Mm. You know, she believed that you need to enter that space that's between, which is when you get those rapid eye movements and things, that's between deep sleep and being awake. Mm. And it's where, you know, she called it hypnagogic. Yeah.
How would one enter into that space?
Well, you need not to put the alarm clock on, and you need to wake up and remain in that penumbra without rushing out of bed. You stay in that suspended moment.
Mm.
And it is a place where you often have those dreams that you can't quite realize until you wake up completely that they're not real. I mean, they don't have the same quality as the dreams that you have when you're completely asleep, because those you sort of know they're dreams. But these ones are the ones where you are really confused and
you can half control them sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the last one I had like that would really freak me out. But anyway,
that's right. They're sometimes quite alarming.
Because
she definitely cultivated that. I mean, she had this little narrow bed, and she had naps and things, and she definitely worked on that sort of form of consciousness very very deliberately. And of course, she meditated because she went to the Tibetans. You're right that she was skeptical and she wasn't sort of into the occult in a. I mean, you could see that in the writing too.
Mm.
She's not. She uses a lot of occult imagery, and is very amusing about it. But it's, you know, Carlos Fuentes. Mm. You probably know. Did you know?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Carlos Fuentes said it was ironic sorcery. I think that's a very good phrase.
Yeah. No, it is. It's just a little bit of distance, but yet also is, in a nice way, the kind of being into it as well, being into the, you know, these things that we don't understand.
It's so interesting for me to hear what she's like in New York. 90% of what you describe sounds familiar, but there's a whole meditative. I don't think she did that anymore.
Well, she was living a very solitary life in New York. I mean, and you know, she gave me a lot of time. When I look back on it, I wonder, you know, did she really want to spend so much time with me? But I fell completely in love with her. You know, it was a great sadness to me when she left to Mexico, and somehow I wasn't going to see her again. And so she had the most amazing charm. I want to tell one story.
Please,
perhaps two stories. One, it picks up on your grey clothes. She said, "I've got Pablo is coming, my son, her son, from Chicago, where he was quite a high up doctor." And she said, "I have to be respectable." This was the grey is all part of her attempt to be respectable. So I have to be respectable for Pablo. I do not want to shock Pablo.
Wearing?
Well, no, she was perfectly respectable. I mean, but she said, "We have to go and buy me a dress." So we went to a shop, which was a sort of dime store, and we went into a basement. There was racks of terrible clothes. Anyway, she found some dresses and went off into the changing room and came out, and one at a time. And then she said, "Well, which one did you like best?" And I said, "Well, Leonora, I think they're all right within the genre, but they're all much, much too big for you." And she said, "Oh, but you see, I must be entirely covered. Because otherwise Pablo will be shocked." Anyway, on the other end of the spectrum of her is that we often gossiped a lot about sex and love and men. She said, "Oh, it's a curse to be heterosexual," which I agreed with. it's just a way. I mean, you could far prefer being with women, but you know the trouble is the drive. Anyway, I said, well, sort of. Then another artist, Stella Sneed, who was a surrealist photographer, did collages, was living in New York, had been at the art school with Leonora, a little bit older, died before her. Stella came to dinner one night in this very, you know, informal kitchen, Leonora's. And they were talking about their last love affairs. Stella's had been on the boat coming to New York a long time before. And Leonora looked up to the ceiling. She said, you know, I gave up sex when I lost my last tooth. So she, I mean, she really was extremely entertaining.
We do have, I mean, I don't know if there are questions in the audience and whether we want to start opening up for questions. I mean, I wanted to sort of ask you too why, I mean, we've talked about how wonderful she was as a person, but I wanted to connect up the art and life a little bit and talk about, you know, why are you interested in her again now? What do you think, what is this thing that persists about her pictures, but also her writing and, you know, Why? What's going on now? Or why is she so interesting to both of you?
But just, well, mentioning her essay, Female Human Animal, and the idea of, well, that essay is very much a statement of breaking free from patriarchal structures or systems, but also of identity being very fluid, and one is, well, female, human, animal, not necessarily in that order, but one exists and inhabits the world in that way. And she was, well, I come if I said it downstairs, but anyway, there was such a continuum between her voice, her spoke. There was just such a fierce authenticity, and the person she was in front of you was exactly, it carried into, there was no pretension, there was no artifice. There's most artists or writers I've met, there's some mask or there's some pretension, but with her, it was, she defies categorization.
Mm.
I mean, you've written about her so wonderfully. And more scholarly.
No, but well, I mean, I think that there's simply a remarkable phenomenon of someone who is, you know, an artist and a writer of equal strength. And one of the things that was sort of disappointing in the past, and you've remedied, is that somehow she wasn't getting acknowledgement for her writing. The people saw it as sort of secondary, but it sort of isn't, and there is a constant fusion, overlap of imagery between them. And method, I think, too, the kind of approach. And she, but I mean, we mustn't sort of forget that it was the story that carried her to prominence. I mean, it was because of the joining the surrealist movement in the 30s, the curious background, very unusual background, actually, for an artist. She was, you know, the daughter of a sort of big industrialist. She makes quite a lot of it in Down Below, the account of when she had this sort of crisis of her, sort of nervous crisis when Max Ernst had been arrested for the second time and taken to, because he was first arrested as a German, then went against France, I mean, as a German national, he was arrested by the French at the beginning of the war. Then a lot of petitions were brought to bear and he was released. And then the Germans overran France and he was arrested as a degenerate German by the Germans. And again, and she was pretty much 19, I think, left alone in this extremely critical situation with all her friends being deported and everybody she knew in what various forms of flight. And she had a breakdown down below. And so that gave her a status as one of the great witnesses to mental distress. It's a very remarkable text.
Which in your review books are republishing at the end of the month.
Down Below. Which had a very strange publishing history, which I won't go into, but it survived as a document, and it's a very remarkable document. It's on the same kind of caliber as Judge Schreber's Memoirs of My Nervous Illness, because it operates on two forms of consciousness. She remembers extremely well how mad she was, as if she hadn't been mad at all, and so she kind of chronicles it perfectly with great lucidity. So it exists in these two planes, and that gave her, you know, she became a great figure within surrealism. I mean, André Breton really, you know, rated her, and she had many friends because they all fled, as you know, your family knew too, to Mexico, which gave them amnesty, gave amnesty to people who had been persecuted by the Germans in Europe.
Sort of seems extraordinary at the moment we're at in the world.
Exactly,
now,
because the socialist government just said, you're welcome here. So there was an enormous colony as a result of some very remarkable people.
Yeah.
They were dirt poor. There was no sort of no support. So, but they did some very interesting work as a result, actually. Benjamin Perret did some excellent work in Mexico when he was, in fact, there. So she was then part of that community. And then she was lost, I think, to view in a way from the perspective, the Eurocentric perspective, not in Mexico. In Mexico, she became a great figure there.
Mm. It was public art and things still.
Yes. You probably want to say about her work as a...
Well, we always felt that it was so often, and when I worked, I co-created the show at Tate Liverpool, I'd say 60% of the time people think I was referring to Dora Carrington. And I was so surprised by how here in her country. And in Mexico, she was very much a public figure. And she hated being approached, but she would be. And even, well, I mentioned it briefly in my A to Z, but across the street, with the huge pile of rubble, the collapsed building that over the years was being colonized and growing community. And she felt very threatened by it, but she also had a fascination. I realized it was also ruins, and somehow the idea of a ruin right in front of her house. And whenever Cheeky asked me, I lived in Berlin for 6 years, and whenever Cheeky would ask me, where are you living? I'd say Berlin, and he'd say, is it still in ruins? Mm. 60 years later, he still felt it was this battered, demoralized city. And Leonora would always say, how can you live in Germany? And towards the end of her life, when she began to lose her hearing, her doctor wanted to send her to an institute, a German institute, and she didn't go. She said she scares me full of Germans.
Right.
And, well, it wasn't. And
I think the other thing that's sort of interesting, I mean, when you mention about the situation in Mexico City, I was reminded, of course, that she was very political.
Yeah,
I mean,
yes.
But she was denounced, in 1960, she was denounced by Octavio Paz's ex-wife, Elena Garro, who drew up a list of intellectuals, she was left-wing, who had incited the students.
Yes. Right. So there's kind of...
But she fled, she left after
she
that.
She went to New York.
Well, when they were shot, how many were shot? An awful lot of students
Hundreds.
She left Mexico City. That was the first time she came to live in New York. But actually, she then went back to Mexico, and then left again when I met her that time. But it's interesting that this is a kind of loyalty to the Bretonian surrealism in its pure form, where they saw it as a political movement against constraint and oppression, against conventional.
Oh, so it's a reconnection back to the beginning. I hadn't thought of it like that.
And I think also there's a political element in her use of Mexican folklore and Mexican belief systems. Mm. So she had this very strong commitment to the idea of the animal familiar, and brought it into some of her paintings very frequently.
The Nahuatl.
Yes, and that in a way was asserting the crushed, Indian communities, the pueblos within Mexico. Now that sounds less kind of, surprising to us, but actually the sort of hierarchical vision of societies in Latin America.
Yeah, and that mural, the magical world of the Mayas.
So it's a retrieval, a passionate retrieval of something that had been silenced and muted. Mm. And I think the idea of engaging through this kind of dreamlike states was a way of asserting the connection of all human beings within, getting rid of the colonial mentality that our rational, evolved, whatever, civilization should, domesticate and change this backward, sort of illiterate. That she was really trying to sweep that away, and I think it shows in the stories, too.
Yeah, sort of hippie and political at once.
Yes, that's right, yes, hippie.
Alice, you're sort of a younger generation, and you've written about Leonora for the LRB, and what was it that draws you to her, or why you think it's interesting to her?
I think it's just remarkable that so few people have heard of her. I mean, it's completely mind-boggling. Someone who is so amazing as an artist and as a writer. If she had been a man, everyone would know who she was, I'm sure of it. And I can't help feeling that her rejection of a certain sort of Britishness has contributed to that, and that we're all very late to the party.
Yeah. And yet she had postcards of the royals on her kitchen counter.
Did she? Yeah.
And that's what's so appealing about the stories. Yeah.
But she liked the Queen Mother. She said they're harmless but expensive.
But you know, they did that calculation every year, which says it only costs us £2. That's just with us still quite expensive. Yeah.
The Queen Mother was almost a sort of bird, wasn't she? She always wore those hats with sort of feathers.
Well, I think she would have liked the dressing up.
I've really run over because I'm terrible.
I just wanted one final anecdote. That just her final words that her son told me, Gabby, which was... She was staring very fixedly at a wall, a blank wall, and Gabby said, "What are you looking at, Mother?" And she said, "Birds." He said, "Where?" He said, "Hundreds of them, birds, blackbirds on the wall. Magnificent blackbirds." Those are her last words. Mm.
Wow.
Mm. So the landscape of her child, the bird from...
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions? Probably got about 5-10 minutes if anyone's got any.
I just wondered if you can maybe think about her in the context of Ithel Colquhoun's writing, because she's another female surrealist. English surrealist.
I didn't catch
that. Ithel Colquhoun?
Ithel Colquhoun,
yeah.
I just wondered if... Because you're talking about people who are not necessarily that well known. Mm. And just there's so many correlations between their writing and their painting and their methods of making. And I just wondered if there was anything.
Well, I've only read... Is it The Goose of Hermogenes? Yes. That's the only one I've read. And I didn't think it was as... I didn't think it had the... coruscating quality of mischief. I thought it was much more straightforward surrealism in the sense of, I mean, I may be quite wrong, but you know, sometimes the surrealist imagination can be rather solemn about its subject. And I felt that, I'm afraid I didn't, but you know, because one of the books we haven't mentioned, because it's not, is The Hearing Trumpet, which is Leonora's full-length novel, which incidentally, of course, is about Lapland. You were talking about
the last sentence.
The last sentence, yes. And that is a real masterpiece, you know. I mean, really kind of a fully achieved, extraordinary combination of massive research into occult theories, but at the same time, this levity. And when she was quite a young woman, this writing about old age, the crone, in this utterly energetic and very, very subversive way. So, and I felt, I'm afraid that it's quite a long time since I read The Ithel Colquhoun, but... Though I sort of admired it, it didn't give me quite the same warmth sort of feeling as
as
Carrington.
I have a perspective on this that I'd like to know. I think that you will share it with me, which is her relationship to animals and humans. I feel that she. Maybe because she had to break away from her family and then she fell into the war and she'd had all these problems with human organization, that she really preferred the animal world, and that this was seen through the painting and through the writing, and that if I were picking A, I would say A for absurd, that she felt that humans had a certain, that everything was absurd, that nothing mattered, and that you would be better off if we could have somehow gone into the animal world and only communicated with them. I'm speaking from a point of view of the fact that when I was, as I told you, when I was 23, I knew her in Mexico City for a few years.
She once said to me, she said, horses are so generous. They lend us their intelligence. She felt that also about dogs.
And cats and hyenas.
There was a tree she'd planted 50 years.
Marina, could you tell us a little bit more about Down Below? I'm not even sure when she wrote it. I don't know very much about it. But it sounds like a significant work from her life, and I'm really looking forward to reading it. When did she write it, and when did it get published?
It was published in 45 or 6. She wrote it soon after. She first dictated it to the doctor, Pierre Mabille, who was one of the surrealists, in the circle of the surrealists, who fled to Mexico from France. And then it was written down by his wife in French. And then it was published in French.
I think immediately after the war. And then it was translated back with her corrections. Yeah, it's a very high, in that sense, highly detective. It has very interesting illustrations, including a marvelous portrait of one of the psychiatrist doctors.
By her.
By her, yeah, absolutely, yes. And a map of the psychiatrist of the of the hospital where she was in, you know, kept. And she was given an early form of electroconvulsive therapy, which was extremely harsh. And she also, there are numerous characters, the nurses, the doctors. There's also a lot of family trouble because the family went set out to fetch her back after war broke out, to try and get her back. And they sent the nanny. This is a sort of very young. They sent her nanny, who had actually been her sort of, you know, companion all her life, because she hadn't left the household. I mean, even though she'd grown up and left home.
And as far as you're aware, is it factually correct?
It reads as if it's a chronicle, yes. But it's shot through with her, this sort of very lively internal life that she has in everything she does. So, you know, the wall between what is experienced in the world and what's experienced in her mind is not a very, this is not a defining wall in Leonora's way.
Probably
of
difficult
being,
to talk about factual in that context, probably.
I was just thinking about her life in New York. I read Joanna Moorhead's book and it doesn't say very much about it. I'm thinking how great it would be if she'd met Louise Bourgeois. Did she? Did she mix with other artists there? They would have been such an interesting meeting.
I don't remember her mentioning Louise. Louise Bourgeois wasn't, you know, she was not very well known then. But in the mid-80s, that she emerges after that. She was the person who was known and who she might have known, Leonora, because their actual interests did converge, is the husband of Louise Bourgeois, who was into, he was an ethnographer. You know, he was an anthropological art historian. I mean, she didn't like socializing. I don't know if she did in Mexico.
No, not at all.
She didn't go out to things. She stayed in her burrow, where she dreamed and painted. And then there were quite a lot of people like me who would find her. And she was always very welcoming and would talk to us. She was very, as you said, you know, she had no... She was very unvain, quite extraordinarily unvain.
The Louise Bourgeois comparison interesting for you, Chloe and Alice, does that say anything?
Definitely. No, I would love to know, but she never mentioned herself. So.
But the she had spiders, been very close, of course, to the Mexican artists. I mean, the Cathy Horner, Remedios Varo.
And
Remedios was a great passion of hers. She really loved Remedios. And she
it was the friendship she considered
the central friendship of her life. And she was convinced that Remedios had been murdered.
We're not just celebrating the 100th, you know, anniversary of Leonora Carrington's birth, but we're also celebrating the 25th anniversary since Angela Carter's death. And it doesn't surprise me that Angela Carter was very, very interested in Leonora Carrington's work, that they seem like soulmates to me. And these anniversaries are obviously very helpful in bringing these messages to the fore, but I feel like maybe there's something more that we've got to say about the feminist cause at this moment in time. And Marina and Chloe, I just wonder if you can maybe impart some of your wisdom from the 1980s and whether you think that there might be resurgence today. I was very young when those books were coming out. I was an infant, and I just wonder if maybe there's something that's going on at this very moment in time that is kind of interest to us.
Yeah, I always think about this in relation to waves. Like, why do we always have to dip? We hang back up. Why can't we just, you know? Is there anything one can say to us?
I feel I've done an awful lot. That's why I
went. No, but you're much better answering these questions than I am. Because I grew up in Mexico City, and there wasn't, and I only noticed it when I went to university in the United States, how self-possessed and confident and assertive my contemporaries were, the women. And I, well, probably to this day, but I just wasn't as practiced or as comfortable in asserting myself or my thoughts or ideas. And so to embark on this friendship, family friendship with Leonora, because one-on-one, maybe once or twice I saw her, but And at the time I smoked, and she was always very annoyed when the times I'd quit, and we bonded over well, that love of animals. Yes, but she was so formidable, and she definitely immediately sensed she preferred the company of women. Again, not sexually, but in every other way. She very much, in a room, paid much more attention to the women and just felt much more comfortable. I'm still processing what the imprint has left in a more tangible, conscious way. But of course, Angela Carter.
It's quite uncanny, actually, because I don't think that Angela Carter could have read a lot of her work. So she anthologized the debutante.
And she translated it as well, yeah. That's her own translation in Wayward Girls and whatever that's called.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay, yes. And she probably knew the hearing trumpet. But it is uncanny, actually, because even this sort of shape over the arc of their lives is similar, because it begins with these erotic fables, and then she writes this, exuberant study in old crones, which is very similar to how Wise Children has Dora and Nora Chance as these sort of old hoofers who've been through so much, and it's full of carnivalesque life, and that's really quite similar in terms of the sensibility. So, yes, but I suppose one of the things that one might say, and I agree with you, that it's a moment of terrible disarray on so many fronts of ideas. And, of course, terribly, desperately disappointing that we have so many female leaders, most of whom are sort of not interested in, the rights of, not even women, but I came across a quotation which, in an article about refugees, that Theresa May had given an interview in the Daily Telegraph when she was Home Secretary, saying, "We are going to create a truly hostile environment for people coming, seeking refuge."
That's appalling.
Yeah. I mean, I'll have to get the actual date of this interview in the Telegraph. But I sort of remember that from when she was Home Secretary. I remember her saying, "There will be gunboats in the Channel if they try to come on our shores." And this, in some ways, actually, Leonora doesn't have any female characters who are like that. She has Frau Asegurado in Down Below, who's a kind of cruel, sadistic nurse. But not, on the whole, she's interested in opening up possibilities. It's sort of surrealist desire to break down what exists and seed the convention so they grow in a different shape and become completely effloresce into the world and unsettle things. And that hope is really, I think Leonora, Angela also have that. And, we don't know what Angela Carter would have said about the current situation. It's a shame. It would be great to know.
I think that's the right depressing note to end on. Thank you all so much.
I just want to say, this is the last picture, month before she died, that my parents took of her with Yeti, diminutive, abominable snowman. But her dentist gave it, provided a lot of happiness. Just end on a happier note.
Yeah,
okay. Yeti provided a lot of happiness in the last 3 years of her life.
But she's smoking.
So I want to thank our panel so much for joining us today.
Thank
and
you.
All you for coming. And please stay around, have a glass of wine, buy the book. That might help feminism a little tiny bit.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Look at all the books.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.